In the West, we are now being attacked and jailed because of the criminalization of calling out the genocide and being basically identified as pro-Palestinian or trying to stop a genocide. That we are the ones that are being punished now, where the Israelis are not being punished by anybody's government yet.
I just spoke to Dr. Robin Anderson, a professor and author, who exposes how the media has lied to us, specifically about Israel and their genocide against the Palestinians. We covered a wide range of subjects, from what really happened on October 7th, what happened before October 7th, what has Israel been doing since then, and how the media has lied about not only what happened on October 7th, but Israel's ongoing genocide against the Palestinians. I hope you enjoy it. Such an honor to have you. I first heard of your work actually from an interview you did with the Institute for Middle East Understanding. I came across that article, which I'll put a link to below, read it, and then I had to get your book, The Complicit Lens, and I started reading through it, and I said, okay, I definitely need to get you on the show because you're tackling a very important subject for the audience. Just to be familiar, the book is called The Complicit Lens, U.S. Media Coverage of Israel's Genocide in Gaza. So that kind of gives you a feel for this, and I got a lot of questions for you. So I just say, let's go ahead and dive in if that's okay with you.
Sure.
You know, let's maybe start with October 7th. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, and you actually note this in the book, history began for them on October 7th. But of course, in reality, there's a whole lot of stuff that happened before then. So maybe set the stage and tell us what happened prior to October 7th. What was Israel doing in relation to the Palestinians?
Well, Israel had already been declared an illegal occupation and an apartheid state by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And various human rights organizations and the UN had already documented by that point also instances where Israel had basically committed war crimes against the Palestinians in Gaza. And by saying that, what I mean is when the civil society groups in Gaza planned these peaceful demonstrations at the wall, and they went on in 2018 for, you know, most of the year, and Israel wound up injuring 33,000 Palestinians, killing almost 300. No Israelis were killed. And they kept saying they're threatening us, they're doing all this horrible stuff. And meanwhile, they weren't. So the human rights organizations had appealed already to the ICC in 2018 to investigate these as war crimes. And as war crimes, they're disproportionate violence, or you can't attack civilians. And who weren't presenting an imminent threat. And since no Israelis dies, they certainly weren't threatening them. So there was that, and there were a number of other incidents in 2021 where they took out four apartment buildings, one apartment building in Gaza being the building that housed both Al Jazeera and AP. And that was what we call disproportionate violence. And making civilians pay for something that their fighters or leaders did. And those are by definition war crimes. And those things had been happening. Of course, you know, those are just the most recent and the most important things to point at before October 7th. But we now know, I think, that this has gone back since 1948. And as Rashid Halidi, who wrote the introduction to my book, he traces it back even further. So this violence didn't just happen on October 7th. It was a long in the making, a long genesis, and Israel used it very much to justify what they did subsequently during the genocide.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like just in my own research, you know, the founders of the State of Israel had already planned on ethnically cleansing the people. So you're right. This does appear to predate even 1948, let alone, you know, October 7th.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, by starting the violence on October 7th, what that allowed them to do in terms of the logic of a media frame that is very common in the representation of war and war reporting is all the violence started on October 7th. It was out of nowhere. They had no idea where it came, right? It was a surprise. If you recall, it was a surprise attack. So they couldn't anticipate it. Of course, they could have anticipated it because the Palestinians and Hamas was posting online. They're messing around with balloons and practicing and those kinds of things. So Israel wasn't there at the borders when Hamas went in mysteriously, but what they were ready with was right there with their propaganda campaign and their demonization of Hamas, because if there wasn't any reason for them to do it, then it was just these horrible Arab terrorists who did things like chop off babies' heads and rape a lot of women, all of which was fabricated very early on and ready to go with the media by the Israeli propaganda machine.
I remember seeing those reports really early on, and then I started seeing some people say, well, hey, this is fake news, it didn't really happen. But, you know, at the time, I wasn't following it as closely as I should have. But I do recall kind of encountering, you know, different competing narratives on that particular point with the babies. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that? What exactly happened there? I mean, I still hear people, I saw Rabbi Shmuley on Piers Morgan just the other day repeating this talking point. So, I mean, it's still indoors unto this day. So what's going on there?
It goes back to war propaganda. It's classic war propaganda of the 20th century that began in World War I, where, of course, the Germans were supposedly bouncing babies off their bayonets. And then it was repeated during the first Gulf War, Desert Storm, when the member of the Kuwaiti royal family testified before Congress that these infants in incubators had been thrown like sticks on the hospital floor when the Iraqis went in. Of course, 350 babies in a remote area of the border between Kuwait and Iraq. How did so many babies, were it really that many the premature babies in an incubator? The whole thing was a sham, and it was later understood and media actually apologized for it. But these things are standard. So journalists in places, you know, journalists that were covering this, these are our seasoned journalists. This is the most important conflict that was happening. And yet they didn't recognize this beheaded baby stories as war propaganda. Nor did they try to really research it or ask Israel for evidence. They just printed it and you know, because gosh, Netanyahu had called up President Biden and told him that they had rounded up these infants and then they burned them, and it was just like the Holocaust. Within a month, the Israeli insurance center, it's a service that they have in Israel, and they had documented the demographics of the people who were killed on October 7th. There was exactly one infant below the age of two who was killed that day by a bullet. I'm sad to say, but not rounded up and burned and beheaded. And we say, well, why did they do that? As Richard Sanders, you know, the British documentarian who did a wonderful documentary called October 7th. And he said, ironically, media reported not on what Hamas did, but on what Hamas did not do that day. And what they did not do is behead babies or rape women. There you have it.
I recall seeing this being discussed in Al Jazeera's documentary on October 7th, which you do talk about also in the book. And so maybe clarify that last part there where they were talking about systematic rape. I know they addressed that in the documentary. You talk a little bit about it here. We heard it all over the news, but it seems that there really isn't evidence for that. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, a whole chapter in my book is about that New York Times piece that was widely distributed and right at first thought very credible, that came out late December 2023. And it was called Screams Without Words. And it had I call it trauma porn. It was probably the worst horrifying descriptions of brutality and rape against women that has ever been in print in the US media. I mean, it was really outrageous, and it would have been one thing had it happened. However, there was no verifiable eyewitness accounts of that report. There was no eyewitness accounts, any survivors. There was no forensic evidence. There was no visual evidence. Many of the people who they relied on as sources had been already discredited, even some of the stories. In that, for example, just one example, there was two teenage sisters who were supposedly found separated, in long descriptions of how they had semen on their back. That was just horrible stuff. As it turns out, the BBC had published a month earlier the interview with the grandmother of the two teenagers that they wrote about that were from Kibbutz Be'eri. And the grandmother says, "My daughter was killed with her arms around her daughters, protecting them. And then, but she couldn't protect them. They were shot by Hamas." Right. So Hamas really did commit war crimes that day. We don't know how many civilians ultimately they killed. They might have killed 600. You know, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about really more than 700, let's say. But they killed civilians. It was against international law. But that wasn't enough. They needed to really whip up some of the most kind of vile fear and disgust that we know these kinds of stories evoke in people, because they needed the ultimate persuasion to justify what they were doing by December, what they were doing. And what they were doing had already been identified as genocide. And South Africa, right at the end of December, was submitting its suit in front of the International Court of Justice. You know, and then the first, you know, 7 pages, they document how the Israelis incited the genocide. But there is evidence to show that, and all we have to see is look at the timing of this New York Times report, the timing is very odd and served to deflect concern away from the South African case of genocide. And allow it to kind of be ignored in the news cycle.
That almost sounds familiar, because didn't they come out with a report at the same time that one journalist came out with a report about how dogs are raping people in some of these Israeli prisons? And then it seems like the Zionists immediately came out with a rival report at the same time.
That's true. I wrote a piece subsequent to the book called A Balancing Act at the New York Times. So finally, the New York Times, I guess in the spring of this year, allows their primary journalist, human rights journalist, Nicholas Kristof, to publish the truth about what's going on in Israeli dungeons, about the widespread sexual violence by Israel against the Palestinians. This story had been out, you know, literally for years and for months and even years. We knew this was happening, but suddenly, not until the spring of this year, did they allow Nicholas Kristof to report on it. The very next day, they have another piece in the Times that talks about yet another investigation that Israel has done into the Hamas rape. And they weaponized rape against Israeli women once again. Oh, and they had this trove of documents, 10,000 videos, and finally, you know, they're purporting to have all this visual and evidence. And probably
did they release any of it?
No, that was the thing.
Right.
But okay. They couldn't release it. Darn it, they couldn't release it.
Of course. Right. Yeah, okay. So, you know, back to October 7th, though, you mentioned civilians. And yes, it's true, as you know, Hamas did commit war crimes that day and also killed civilians. By the way, I was a little unclear on this part of your book. Is your assessment that there was a directive, an official directive to target civilians on part of Hamas?
I think, well, if you look at Richard's Richard Sanders' documentary, he says they moved right in on to the military, a lot of the military bases
yep.
That exist and have been established along the border between Gaza and Israel. And that's where the fighters went. That's where they went. They didn't know, improbably, but in fact, they didn't know, Richard Sanders says, they didn't know that the music festival is happening. So then they went in and they were trying to take hostages at Kibbutz Be'eri, right? So those are war crimes. They did kill civilians. They took hostages, which you can't do. And actually, it's really not, it's actually also a crime, not as heinous a crime as civilians, but if you attack soldiers who are not ready to be attacked, right, they were in their beds, right, then that is a violation of certain international war regulations. But they did commit, I don't think we'll know what Hamas told them to do, but what we do know is that they were hanging around a lot waiting for Israel, and that's what he says. They were surprised that Israel wasn't coming to attack them, wasn't coming to fight them. And a young Israeli woman named Yasmin Barat, she fled the rave, the music festival, and she went into Kibbutz Be'eri, and she was captured by Hamas. And she says she was in Kibbutz Be'eri with about a total of 12 hostages. They waited there for 10 hours with the fighters, who didn't harm them, didn't kill them. She said they said to her, you know, it's not our intention to harm you. And then here comes the Israelis and open fire on everybody. And she's the only hostage that survived that attack. And so they, right there, they killed, you know, almost a dozen hostages. So this is things that have been documented and reported in the Israeli media. But in our establishment media and our corporate legacy media, they haven't reported on this. Throughout the genocide, they continue to say this standard Israeli line, the standardized narrative, that Hamas killed 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, total of about 800 civilians, mostly civilians that day. We don't know how many civilians Israeli forces killed, but we know they killed.
Yeah, I mean, I just got in the mail some propaganda from a Christian Zionist organization, and they're saying on October 7th, 12,000 civilians were killed. It's not exactly true. I'm sorry, 1,200
right,
civilians.
1,200.
Not exactly true, though.
Not exactly
still,
true.
You know, it's still maybe debatable how many of those were civilians. You noted the number moments
ago.
Well,
and that's because the Israelis haven't allowed any international investigations to go in. That's all blocked by Israel.
Well, yeah, and that leads to another related question. So I guess maybe two questions for you. You had mentioned there what sounds like Israel targeting some civilians. So you talk a little bit about the Hannibal Directive. Maybe tell us a little bit about that, what exactly it is. How do we know if it was employed on October 7th? Let's maybe go there.
Right. Well, there was one military guy who said, right away, this looks like it was a Hannibal directive. Hannibal directive is something that was passed in Israel. It's a military directive that tells their forces to kill everybody in a hostage situation. They don't want hostages taken. It was a consequence to successfully bargaining with hostages, and they didn't want that to happen. I was trying to remember something the way you put it, but at any rate, the Hannibal Directive. So we know that it happened based on a pretty thorough investigation by Israel's oldest newspaper, Haaretz. And Haaretz talked to the pilots of the Apache helicopters. They talked to low soldiers and also the hierarchy of generals and people who called it in. And they confirmed that, yes, there is plenty of evidence to confirm that the Hannibal directive was used that day. Of course, Yasmin Borat, what she says is, it's not that the Israelis deliberately killed hostages. It's that, or Israelis. But for example, over the rave, over the music festival, when so much was made of this in the early days and continues to be made about it, that Hamas, as I said, they didn't even know there was a festival going on. But pilots in Apache helicopters got into their helicopters with full munitions and unloaded the bellies of those helicopters over the rave as Hamas was taking hostages, and hostages were on the ground, and Hamas, they were riding in cars, and Hamas and hostages were riding in the cars on the way to the border, trying to get back to the border. So they've talked to pilots, and the pilots says, yeah, we didn't know who we would be really targeting. We just bombed the rave to stop Hamas getting back to the border.
Seems like there was also a video that was leaked not too long ago where someone high up in the government was discussing what sounded like the Hannibal directive. Then in comes Ben-Gavir and starts yes. talking, but then realizes he's being recorded and then tells them to shut it off. But by then, I mean, the cat is out of the bag. They had already discussed and admitted to what sounded like the Hannibal directive.
Itamar Ben-Gavir, you can hear him actually saying it. Yeah, we need to do this. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's amazing that some people still deny it when there's so much evidence here.
Yes.
Well, okay, so you said that also they won't allow for independent investigations. And I came across that part, and I specifically wanted to ask you about that. Are you basing that on the UN's commission? It seems like, according to the footnotes, you're basing that on the UN's commission that tried to reach out to Israel to get, you know, transparency on the situation. It looks like they were just completely ignored.
Yes. And, you know, there are, the UN puts together experts, fact finders, and they group them from different countries, and they're independent. This goes in. But Israel always says over and over again, not just after October 7th, but before, but particularly after, oh, this will be biased against Israel. Don't worry, you know, countries are supposed to rein in their own military. They're supposed to do their own investigations. But obviously, because in so many cases before October 7th, most notably the assassination of the Palestinian-American journalist working for Al Jazeera, Shireen Abu Akleh, who was literally targeted and assassinated. They called for independent investigations into her death. 33 press organizations from all over the world. And it was a huge deal. And Israel refused to do an independent investigation. And they said, oh, we're looking into it. But what we know is that not one Israeli soldier has ever been kept in jail for killing a Palestinian, right? So those investigations, and one of the ways that the massacres and the killing in Gaza was normalized, and what I mean by normalized is this process where you've got reporting on the ground. So what we had in Gaza were two very different narratives. We had actual Palestinian reporters, great reporters on the ground in Gaza, no establishment media unless they were embedded, that's another story, but particularly in the beginning, no outside reporters were allowed into Gaza, and there were people on the ground in Gaza because Al Jazeera had a bureau there. So they were reporting from that, from there. They would say, this is a massacre, Jabalia, the flour massacre. This is what happened. Israel fired into innocent, starving Palestinians and killed them. And then Israel would say, no, we didn't. No, here's some evidence. Look. And then they would, then a few days later, you know, the BBC would look at the, a satellite video and said, well, you know, this is edited in four places. So we can't really see when they actually fire. So this whole process postpones judgment, postponed, because when you've got establishment media constantly repeating what the Israelis say and very much downplaying what's happening on the ground to the Palestinians, saying things like a body count. Oh, but this was a body count recorded by the Hamas controlled Gaza health ministry. So we're supposed to take that as a flag that, ooh, we don't know really how accurate those body counts are, do we? And then meanwhile, giving great credence over and over again to the same types of propaganda, the same use of pseudo evidence throughout the genocide. This is how the genocide was normalized, because you go from one, then the news cycle changes, and then you go to another massacre, and it's the same thing, and another massacre. And you've never called, you've never used the terms that we understand what Israel was doing, because they also had editorial directives that told them you can't use the language of international law. So, you know, there are so many complex ways in which the Palestinians were belittled, dehumanized, not their deaths not recorded properly, and the Israelis continued to get away with things like that.
And they still won't allow independent journalists and investigations into Gaza. Is that correct?
Right now, what they're doing is they're bulldozing. They're taking tonnage and tonnage of the rubble out. And it's thought that there's would be plenty of forensic evidence in that rubble, you know, bodies, biomaterials, things that could tell them. But no, they are deliberately eliminating that for future.
Are they doing that so that we won't realize the body count is a lot higher than we had previously thought?
I think yes. I mean, I'm sure that's what it is. But there are. This idea that they've only killed, what, now we're up to 74,000 Palestinians is, in my opinion, an absurdity. To continue to report that. That's the actual number of people that they actually know were killed. How many people are under the rubble? How many people are dying every day right now from conditions in Gaza, from starvation? From lack of medical, from lack of oxygen, from cancer, from all of the things, because they destroyed every bit of civilian infrastructure in Gaza. The idea, they're now in about 30% of the Gaza Strip that they used to occupy. How can we even imagine that this is only 72,000 or 74,000 Gazans that have been killed? It's ridiculous. And medical organizations have, they have ways of calculating how many people die from violence in these kinds of attacks, and they have estimated them uniformly far over that number.
I have a concern here. So, I mean, one of the ways that we know about the atrocities of the Holocaust is because the Nazis kept records of all these things, and we can access those things and determine what exactly happened based on that. But here, with them bulldozing forensic data and not allowing independent journalists in, I have a concern that posterity won't really know the full extent of what they have done. Whereas in the case of the Holocaust, we do. In this new Holocaust, if you will, I'm concerned we won't know because they covered it up.
Well, I understand that concern, and that is worrisome. And the fact that they're doing this seems to be an absolute act of desperation. However, this is the most well-documented genocide in history. There's probably enough documentation of this stuff to kill entire forests and paperwork, but now it's all mostly online. But if you look at even the latest thing, that the amazing report that the UN did about how Israel has been targeting children throughout the genocide, but also recently. And you've got doctors, you've got footage. You have simply the destruction of the entire healthcare system. So this is one of the most contested. This is one of the ironies. It remains one of the most contested genocides. But that's because U.S. media and Western media in general keeps repeating what the Israelis say, their justifications, their claims, their pseudo-evidence, their denials. And consider this, Michael, even as we see the likes of Ben-Gvir, Netanyahu talking about greater Israel, we see people in the Knesset talking about how all children should be dead. They're all vermin. They're tomorrow's Palestinian fighters, and we should kill everybody. They're saying that over and over again. We see that online all the time. So now we have this, so many levels of contradiction. So they're going to deny that they've done this. Meanwhile, they're admitting it online. But as long as it doesn't get into, establishment media, as long as the New York Times doesn't report it, then they can continue to deny it. And in their view, they're kind of in this propaganda bubble, right? As long as you believe your propaganda bubble that you can continue to do this, you're going to continue to carry out this brutality. And I don't see how it can continue. But fear not, there is so much documentation, visual, forensic, videotape, photographs of what they've done. Don't forget testimonials. The UN people go in and they ask them and they tell them, and that's primarily how we get information from about this kind of state violence against civilians.
Do you think there will ever be a way to reconstruct the accurate body count?
I think we can make an estimate. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Do you know if anybody has made an estimate right now that sounds reasonable? I'm just curious.
Well, at first, JAMA, The Lancet published a year ago, or at least, probably 2 years ago, 187,000. Mm-hmm. Then somebody did a calculation that kind of went over the internet that said, no, it was more like 650,000.
Right.
But reasonable people I have heard say it has to be at least 500,000. But the thing is, it's only about in this ceasefire, under a ceasefire, another 1,400 at least, and more are killed, and people are dying almost every day.
Yeah.
People have gotten out of Gaza, some, but we can account for those people. But, when they bombed Jabalia, that was the most densely populated place on Earth. There's 2.2 million people in the Gaza Strip when Israel started bombing them. That's very densely populated, given I forget exactly how big the Gaza Strip is, but it's not big. It's just, if you just think of it that way, and you think of how many massacres they had, the tent massacres, and the tragedy or the terrible aspect of what Israel has done is that they're very good at manipulating the rules of war. So they can say, we did warn people that we were going to come in. Netanyahu got away with that in front of the U.S. Congress in July 2024, when they invited he had already been identified as a war criminal. The U.S. Congress invited him to speak before them, and the media did not push back on his complete speech that was nothing but repeated propaganda. Again, everything. And he said, well, we've been protecting civilians because we warned them when to go, when we're going to do it. They have used that. They warned people maybe a half an hour before they're going to bomb. And they're designed to look as if they have complied with the rules of war, but indeed they haven't. And certain international investigators have pointed this out, that Israel is very good at turning the laws upside down and then having them repeated in media. Just let me give you one more example about how that happened with the first horrible assault on Al-Shifa Hospital in November of 2023, where they claimed that they could go into the hospital because Hamas had a big old Pentagon under there with this slick 3D video. It was just reach levels of absurdity. But then the media repeated, well, hospitals are protected, but not if Hamas or not if the belligerent party or has occupied the hospital and is engaging in military operations outside of the hospital. Well, first of all, Hamas didn't have any Pentagon in the hospital. It didn't even have, there were no fighters. The doctors reported over and over again as they pleaded with the international community to stop Israel from doing this as they were about to do it. They said, there's no Hamas here. The doctors testified. They were just about ready to bring in another international investigative team to show them that, in fact, there was no Hamas Pentagon under the hospital. So right away, it was a lie. But secondly, is even if that hospital was taken over by Hamas, even if there were fighters there, the Israelis were still obliged under international law to protect the patients in that hospital, to protect the doctors, to protect the essential medical equipment. Bombing that hospital and destroying the equipment and arresting the doctors and killing patients is absolutely against international law. But that's not how it was reported in international media and in U.S. media and in Western media. And if you think about Biden administration's role, the Biden administration also confirmed to the press that, yes, they had evidence in intelligence information that showed Hamas had fighters underneath that hospital and were using the hospital. Absolutely false. No evidence, no actual reporting of names, investigations that showed this, no release of documents. So that's how they started. That's how they successfully began the destruction of the healthcare system, which is non-existent now in Gaza.
Didn't the Biden administration, maybe Biden himself, say that they have confirmed evidence of beheaded babies? Didn't they also say that?
Yes, Biden repeated a long time because Netanyahu got on the phone and told his buddy Biden that there are pictures. I'll show you pictures. So Biden went along and lied and said, I saw pictures. There were never any pictures. There's no pictures. Right. And the Washington Post, actually, by late November, I said, oh, it's too soon to tell. We haven't seen that. Not so. There was plenty of evidence at that point that the actual Israeli military had said, we have no evidence of beheaded babies. That was the Israeli military early on admitted that.
Oh, I didn't catch that part. I didn't know they admitted that. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. So many directions I want to go with this. Let me ask you, why do you think the media has gone along with this? Why do you think that there very clearly is an intention not to look further into these things, not to scrutinize what the Israelis are saying, not to report the facts, and to really cover up the facts? What's going on with the media?
This runs so long and deep in U.S. media, this pro-Israeli frame. The Israeli lobby was successful before October 7th of really a concerted effort to close down any criticism of Israel, you know that international definition of anti-Semitism as any criticism of the state of Israel has been promoted. Was promoted for years. And I quote in my book, a Mondawise piece, which reprinted a scholarly article, which talks about how this was deliberate to attack the grassroots. It was political, and it was to attack grassroots efforts to bring attention to Israel's role in Palestine. So within civil society, by October 7th, it was a pro-Israeli frame in many aspects of our culture and society. Students had already been attacked, documented, their Palestinian activism was being documented by this organization called Canary Mission. And Canary Mission would defame faculty members and students who had pro-Palestinian activities on campuses, and they were they would do things like contact the employers who the students were graduating, and they had often had jobs, and many students lost their offers for jobs because of this. Canary Mission. Canary Mission is very much still active. It's ties to Israel, along with Honest Reporting, Camera. They're monitoring organizations that look very closely at media coverage. However, what we know is governments lie. What we know is they try to pressure newsrooms. But early on, the New York Times and even CNN allowed their newsrooms to be influenced by Israeli directives and talking points. And journalists at the New York Times were told not to report, as I've mentioned before, not to report on human rights. They couldn't use that. They couldn't say apartheid. They couldn't say occupation. They couldn't say refugee camp. So there was no way that they could help their readers understand what was really going on. Because you need those tools, you need that lexicon, you need those verbiage to explain to people what's going on. This is against international law. No, they can't take out an entire city because they're, you know, an entire refugee camp in Jabalia because they say they killed two Hamas commanders. That is disproportionate violence, and it's attacking civilians, and that's against international law. So that's what Israel, that going back to that October 7th narrative, if you start with the violence of Hamas, then anything Israel does is in response to that violence. It's always retaliatory. It's always defensive and therefore always justified. So that's and to this day, I mean, I just finished a piece that went on to fairness and accuracy reporting about Israel's, you know, about the West Bank's treatment of Roe Conna. Now the supposed, you know, what we call violent settlers there. And the New York Times is still the worst. They're still lying about how the Israeli government, this is a deliberate structure. There are systemic relationships between the settlers in place with the military. They actually, in many cases in these communities, they pay them. They're part of militias. And the New York Times won't tell us that. Even now, even when Roe Conna was attacked and the military came and they were surprised, his team was surprised that they also blocked the roadway where they were in the West Bank. And what does the New York Times does? It repeats, even though there's footage that shows it, they repeat, oh, Israel says that they got there and they let them and they let them go.
They even
right? attacked really?
Him. Yeah, they even attacked him.
Yes. And meanwhile, they're kind of actually giving credence to Netanyahu, who's talking about there's just a handful of young people and they're juvenile delinquents. And this is like levels of absurdity. And yet the New York Times continues to lie about what's going on in the West Bank. And they did the same thing in Lebanon now. And they killed journalists there and they wiped out villages. And they kept saying they were targeting Hezbollah. So just substitute, you know, Hamas for Hezbollah, and they're continuing to do it. And that's why I say we need to bring these people. We need to it is no small feat to actually, or charge to say that they're complicit in a genocide.
Certainly.
That's a big charge. And they need to be held accountable, and they really need to stop.
I have a few more questions. I want to ask you about genocide specifically, but let me ask you this one before I forget. Solutions here, as far as getting the truth out there. Look, I have to say, just from personal experience, I grew up in Israel, son of Christian Zionist missionaries in Jerusalem. So I was fed all of that propaganda, all of the talking points. What got me questioning all of that, the narrative, was what I would see from non-traditional media outlets, not from traditional media sources. For example, Twitter, really big one. But you have to take it with a grain of salt because there's a lot of misinformation there too. But there's also a lot of opportunity to get some accurate information that you wouldn't normally see from traditional media. But I guess you have to be discerning. But be that as it may, I started noticing a lot of stuff that I was seeing there on Twitter, and even video and evidence, video footage that wasn't going with the standard talking points of the media. And so it got me questioning things and then looking into the history of Palestine and all of this. And so that's kind of what got me to change my perspective, is looking at non-traditional media source outlets and going from there. Do you think that that's the solution, is to combat this kind of propaganda that we see with traditional media outlets through social media?
Well, as it played out in Gaza, you're absolutely right to point that out. You know, we did see these two very different narratives. We got as close as we could to what a genocide was like with the Palestinian journalists on the ground. And that information and that documentation and those testimonials went out over the internet. Also, our alternative and independent media in this country did great reporting. And their outlets are also online, and they also post their stuff on social media platforms. So if it weren't for that, they would have been able to cover it up. If it were left to the constructed pro-Israel frames of establishment media that just followed Israeli talking points and repeated their pseudo evidence and could, you know, violated every aspect of their journalistic mission to tell us the truth and just give us information. If it weren't for the social media, we wouldn't know what was happening. You know, there was the film Israelism, and before we got this constant reporting, I don't know if you ever saw it, but it was the young woman who went to the West Bank, and she saw she was just like you. And there are other very outspoken and well-read and personal testimonies of people who were raised in Zionist household, who thought Israel was the safe place for Jews, the city on the hill, bought the whole line that Israel, you know, had a right to exist, you know. Yeah. But these foundations of media coverage and how this happened are now crumbling beneath them, right? You know, we're questioning, and many analysts have now, you know, taken on, you know, this assertion that Israel has a right to exist. And my favorite was Mehdi Hassan, right? So he goes, well, what is Israel? Where are the boundaries? Does it even have national borders? Yeah. And then, of course, there was Francesca Albanese, who said, you know, pretty early on, and you see on the tape that she's at this. Press conference. She's at this presser, and some journalist said, "Do you believe Israel has a right to exist?" And she has to compose herself and not, you know, be nasty. And she says, "Look, Italy has the right to exist. France has a right to exist. But they don't have to. They can get together and they can become a new country, because states don't have a right to exist. People have a right to exist.
Exactly. That's the
distinction. States don't have a right. And where is Israel?" And how can a professed, you know, and not to mention the fact that it is based on the idea of an ethnostate where you don't have human rights for everybody. And yet it's gotten away with this idea that it's the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, these things, you know, have just been considered to be truths for so long, and they are no longer. So I think that we need to keep up pressure. We need maybe possibly new international organizations. There's the anti-Zionist Jewish Congress now. There's International Stars. There's organizations that are trying to stop this and keep these people everybody who supported it accountable. I think what we really need to do to stop it is actually really convince the EU that they've got to stop supplying Israel. And I think if we see the sweep in the midterm elections here, that you know, as a couple of analysts have also reported, that progressive Democrats are winning these primaries because they're campaigning on affordability, Medicare for all, blocking bombs to Israel, and AIPAC. And AIPAC, and taking AIPAC money, with few exceptions, has become the kiss of death. So these are things that we need to follow through on, and that it's happening, but it's too slow. Yeah. It's too slow to save the Palestinians, and we need to force them to open and stop starving and stop bombing desalinization plants. And, you know, this stuff is going on right now, and we need to stop it.
I just saw Israel just a couple days ago bombed a desalination plant in Gaza.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned there that without social media, we would have been duped and we would not have known the truth. That makes me ask the question, how much media propaganda were we given in previous generations? The Iraq War, Vietnam. I mean, I have to now start to question everything.
Well, you should. I wrote about that in a book called A Century of Media, Century of War. But what we know about the invasion of Iraq is that while they accomplished the same thing, the strategies were much, much different, right? Because they turned war into entertainment. So there was this thing called militainment. And then they kind of ignored what was actually happening. And we thought war was this fun, exciting thing that was on the big screen with all the action adventure heroes. And it was, it was first person shooter games. You know, these are Iraq vets coming back and advising on how to do Call of Duty and America's Army. So they turned that war into, but there was no way they could turn Gaza into an entertainment. Right. Now I think we really know that war is about death. It's about suffering. It's destroying our economy. I think we know that now. And that's why when Trump did his Iran thing, if you will, it was the first war really since possibly ever that the American people were against before it started. Yeah. We are now pretty much against war, and we are very educated as to what war really is these days and how much it robs from us. So it's a different playing field. And that's why I have a hard time with people who get up in the morning and they read the New York Times from cover to cover. And I say, why do you do that to yourself?
I don't even go to traditional media outlets, unless it's just to critique them. I don't really go to them as a source of information. I don't know if that's just a generational thing at this point, or if that's just me.
I think it's both. And I think it is generational. And I think we've seen young people come up and really within the Jewish community, I think the divide between pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian is generational, and I think it's because they get their news and information about the world on their handheld devices, and of course that's why so many that's why the attack of TikTok, that's why you've got the likes of Hillary Clinton kind of always calling out big tech and saying, oh, look, they're young people are against the war only because they're watching these false TikTok videos, which is partly true. They're against the war because they're watching social media videos, but the truth, not, you know, not right. False. and that she's the one that helps shape this stuff for elite analysts.
You mentioned earlier genocide. This is a very highly disputed term, and I want you to maybe define it for the audience, and maybe just briefly demonstrate how Israel has met the definition.
Right. There are so many layers of the rules of war mm-hmm. that attempt to protect civilians. But the Genocide Convention was the first one to be passed. And the Genocide Convention happened right after World War II, was proposed 47, solidified or codified by 49. And what genocide understands, as opposed to other, you know, you've got crimes against humanity. You've got some of the things that we've mentioned here. You've got disproportionate violence. You can't make civilians pay for what their leaders have done. That's a crime against war. You're not supposed to hit desalinization plants. That's a crime against war. But taken together, mass murder, adding with what you can arguably identify as the attempt to erase an entire people, their identity, their social structure, their civilian infrastructure, so that to try to wipe them off their land, the attack on mosques, these things are aiming at their religion, their identity, their ties to their homeland as a community. So initially, and today that's really the important aspect that separates genocide itself from other war crimes and crimes against humanity. But what we have in Gaza is clearly that. And when the Israeli military and the other people started saying, we're going to turn Gaza into a tent city. They're not going to have any food. They're not going to have any medicine. They're not going to have any water. When they said they would do that, that is incitement to genocide, because that is understood that these are Palestinians that they have been trying to erase off their land as a settler colonial state for many years. So Francis Albanese understood that genocide is a hard word, because they were saying, oh, how do you know it's genocide? And then there was all this, it's intent. And Israel got away with this for a very long time, saying, oh, well, we didn't intend to kill civilians. We were just attacking Hamas, right? So it's this question of intent. Well, that has been debunked many times. I devoted, a few pages to it. And you don't have to have intent. You're simply destroying people, right? Nobody has ever asked you within the Genocide Convention to parse out if the perpetrators were deliberately doing it or not. Besides, there's so much evidence that shows that Israel has been into Greater Israel, and they're trying to, wipe out the Arabs in Lebanon. They were paying Christians or threatening Christians to tell them where the Arabs were. This is all based in identity and a people, and and that's how the Genocide Convention emerged, and that's what it means. Much more than just mass murder.
You know, it seems to me that if you deny that this is a genocide, wouldn't you also, by the very definition that we're operating here, if we throw it out the window, wouldn't that then lead to a denial of the Holocaust as a genocide? Because this definition was formed on the heels of that. If we're now throwing out that definition, everything becomes in dispute.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you can kind of, look at the Holocaust. Lots of Jews were killed, and that's true. And then they wanted to, kind of erase them. But there was a lot of other people they erased too. Millions. The communists, the various people they didn't like, they also did that too. So, but it's really, the Palestinians have proven, however, that they are, just unwilling to be wiped out, which I think is, and I don't know, but the fact that in the West we are now being attacked and jailed because of the criminalization of calling out the genocide and being basically identified as pro-Palestinian or trying to stop a genocide, that we are the ones that are being punished now, where the Israelis are not being punished by anybody's government yet, right? So I think there's a very clear understanding and also a solidarity that unites us that wasn't united before, where activists and people fighting the fights here understand the connections between their oppression and discrimination and the Palestinians. And we understand the social, the cultural, and the economic mutuality of this deprivation. So I think the cat is really out of the bag.
Do you think that things are going to get worse before they get better?
I don't know. I hope not.
Yeah, I hear you. It's really hard to say. I mean, none of us can predict the future, but it certainly looks like there's tough times ahead, unfortunately.
Well, in a change, I can add that the New York Magazine has now been attacked for using genocide, but they've actually made a statement that's saying, we looked into it. We understand that by all of the definitions, we've identified that this is genocide in Gaza, and therefore we're going to allow it in our magazine. When I thought that was really great. And that's what establishment media should do. Because right away, they banned the word genocide in establishment media.
I mean, it just seems so crazy that establishment media is still going, however, with the narrative, despite the masses clearly taking a different position. Do you think that they're going to have to change their narrative at this point?
I think they are, absolutely. What we have now in terms of our broadcast, you know, we have to be careful. The latest fight, and I think, you know, Mark Ruffalo took it up, was the latest merger, you know, between Paramount and Warner Brothers, and billionaire capture, and that's what, you know, the self-proclaimed the Ellison family. David Ellison as the head of Paramount, and then bought Paramount and then allowed our legacy broadcast news organization to be then run by a self-proclaimed fanatical Zionist. And CBS, I predicted that this wouldn't work because nobody wants Fox News Lite. CBS is expecting, and their viewership are people who expect to see some semblance of investigation, of accuracy, of fact-finding, especially with the program 60 Minutes. And so, you know, Barry Weiss has come. I'm surprised she's still at the head, considering how many viewers they've lost and what's going on at that network, not to mention the incredible turnover of, you know, of either or firing or quitting with really, you know, once really good journalists. But the use of AI and the attempts to monetize all of the media in a way that we, you know, to escalate that, which we've done, is something that we need to really look at. And I think that the efforts to break up the media monopolies are really important. And we really need to go back to a regulatory model that doesn't allow six or five or four corporate conglomerates to determine all of our media, all of our press and media, to control it and therefore help shape the coverage. We really need to realize that this is now reached its limit.
Sounds like that might need to be your next book. I mean, I got to ask. I mean, I'm definitely going to put a link to this in the show notes. Everybody go and check it out. The Complicit Lens. Are you working on anything else right now? I just got to ask.
I'm putting together some of my essays.
Okay. Good.
I write a column also for Al Jazeera that is translated and published in Arabic, and then I also over the course of the genocide, and even before, I've written a lot about war and media, And so I'm putting that together now.
You said you wrote a previous book about propaganda in the last century?
Yes. It's called A Century of Media, A Century of War. And it goes right back to the beginning of the century, how modern war propaganda was propagated in World War I. And it goes about up to 2006. So I cover the war on terror. And what I show is that over the course of history, strategies to manipulate the media and calls to war have been carried out differently, but there are consistencies. And one of the main consistencies is that we know over the course of the 20th century, from experience and watching this stuff, that when we militarize with our, when we are at war, our culture becomes militarized as well. Hmm. And we lose civil liberties at home. So if you think that now people are calling the U.S. military an empire, or we've wanted to be an empire, of course, Donald Trump, you know, is destroying that, so that's not so bad. But empire, empire doesn't have citizens in like they do in democracy. In empires, we have denizens. Denizens don't criticize their government. Mm. Authoritarian governments don't criticize, especially militarized ones. We've got the biggest military on earth. And we have, over the course of this time, encroached on civil liberties and lost press freedoms and freedoms of expression. And we're seeing it really play out also in the other Western democracies now, which is very dangerous. So this is a reason in its own to push back from certainly forever wars, which we find ourselves in since the 21st century.
It sounds like that's my next read, because this whole situation has made me really have to ask. I need to rethink things, you know, a lot of the narrative that I've been told. I need to go and scrutinize it. So sounds like a book that will certainly address that.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you for considering that.
It was such an honor to have you on. Thank you so much. Any other plug that you want to put in for the audience?
No, just the book. It's better to buy it from the publisher itself, or books, rather than, you know, online. So
perfect.
Now you can buy it online, but go through War Books.
Sure. I'll put a direct link to War Books, and I encourage everybody to go and check it out. Thank you so much for writing this and speaking up.
Thank you.
It was an honor. Thank you
for inviting me.
Hey, thanks so much for watching. Don't forget to subscribe. Also, check out my second channel right here on YouTube, Reason and Theology. And by the way, if you want to support the channel, check me out at patreon.com/Reason and Theology.